This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can listen to our radio program on Pacifica stations nationwide and our TV show on Free Speech TV, as well as on our website. Gun violence in the United States is one of those issues that we seem to have thrown up our collective hands in despair at. No matter how high the death toll, conservative gun proliferation activists insist that their right to buy and own guns trumps our right to live in safety. And they have the political power to keep it that way. Only when mass shootings shed light on the issue in shocking ways do we pay attention to the scourge of gun violence. But shootings happen every single day in the US, and most of them are barely noticed except by the people directly impacted. To non-Americans, like my guest today, US gun culture is utterly perplexing. Award-winning writer for The Guardian and Nation, Gary Young, has taken on the challenge of humanizing the daily toll from guns in his new book. The premise is that he picked a single day, November 23, 2013, and shared the stories of 10 different American boys who died in separate incidents around the country on that day. Here is Gary Young in a video for The Guardian telling us about the book.
There was 9-year-old Jaden Dixon, who died in a quiet suburb of Grove City, Ohio. When he opened the door and his mother's ex-partner shot him square in the head.
You could hear his mom inside screaming, "That's my baby, that's my baby." It's one of the worst things I've ever been through.
Tyler Dunn, who was shot dead at a sleepover in rural Michigan after his friend's dad left the boys alone for the evening with several loaded guns. Tyler was 11. And there was Justin Hinnant, aged 18, who didn't realize he had a marked man in the back of his car when a stray bullet caught him in the back of the head. This is not a story about gun control, but it is a story about what happens when you don't have gun control. Because in no other Western country would these stories be possible. Far from being considered newsworthy, these shootings are simply a banal fact of death. The white noise, set sufficiently low that America can go about its daily business undisturbed. This was just another day. If I'd picked a different day, I would have covered different children. Most Americans aren't aware of it. Most Americans don't even see it. But the truth is, this gun violence is happening to children every day.
And that's Gary Young. He is the Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute. We watched a video he did for the Guardian newspaper where he's an award-winning columnist. He also writes for the Nation magazine. He won the Foreign Commentator of the Year Award in Britain and the David Nihan Prize for Political Journalism by Harvard's Shorenstein Center in 2015. His earlier books include Who Are We and Should It Matter in the 21st Century, Stranger in a Strange Land, Travels in the Disunited States, and No Place Like Home, A Black Briton's Journey Through the Deep South. Gary Young now joins me to discuss his newest book, Another Day in the Death of America, a chronicle of 10 short lives. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, let's first start by talking a little bit about what led you to write this book. I thought you made a really interesting point in your book when you say that so many issues, when they impact us personally, that's when they become real to us. And you wrote this book, I understand, when the issue of gun violence in a way touched your family in the community you were living in. Can you frame that for us?
Well, I mean, I think with imagination, we can understand all sorts of things that don't affect us directly, but that when you do know someone who has been, who can't go home because they're undocumented or is in pain and can't get health insurance, then you just understand those issues in a different way. And what I say in the book is that in the first 4 years that I was a correspondent in America, I didn't have kids. And most issues were kind of, I understood them more anthropologically, or my engagement with them was like, oh, that's interesting. And then when I had kids, and they're American kids, you know, they're born in America, and my son spent most of his life in America, then you just relate to all the issues differently because you have skin in the game. And that's, you know, that's true of the gun issue.
Right. Can you read excerpt from your book for our audience? Because your writing style, I think, is really important to this story. It, you know, really makes real what the issues are, from your introduction to your book, Another Day in the Death of America.
Sure. So I just have been describing the kind of banal facts of the day, the weather, the most popular TV shows on that night, and so on. And I say it was just another day in America. And as befits an unremarkable Saturday in America, 10 children and teens were killed by gunfire. Like the weather that day, none of them would make big news beyond their immediate locale because, like the weather, their deaths didn't intrude on the accepted order of things, but conformed to it. So in terms of what one might expect of a Saturday in America, there wasn't a hint of betrayal about this either. It's precisely the tally the nation has come to expect. Every day, on average, 7 children and teens are killed by guns. In 2013, it was 6.75, to be precise. Firearms are the leading source of death among Black children under the age of 19, and the second leading cause of death for all children of the same age group, after car accidents. Each individual death is experienced as a family tragedy that ripples through a community, but the sum total barely earns a national shrug. Those shot on any given day in different places and very different circumstances lack the critical mass and tragic drama to draw the attention of the nation's media in the way that a mass shooting in a cinema or church might. Far from being considered newsworthy, these everyday fatalities are simply a banal fact of death. They are white noise, set sufficiently low to allow the country to go about its business undisturbed. A confluence of culture, politics, and economics that guarantees that each morning several children will wake up but not go to bed, while the rest of the country sleeps soundly.
My guest is Gary Young, reading from his new book, Another Day in the Death of America, Chronicle of 10 Short Lives. So as far as you know, these were 10, and they happened to be all boys, killed in this 24-hour period that you chronicle. But you can't be sure that these were the only ones killed, because you had to rely on local news reports, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm almost certain that they weren't the only ones who were shot dead that day. On average, 7 kids are shot dead, 2 of whom would be suicides, and suicides aren't reported generally. So there are no suicides in this book. So there's almost certainly more children who were shot dead that day. And beyond that, I was relying on my own research plus different kinds of crowdsourcing that was taking place at the time. Slate did a gun tally. The New York Times did a gun report. So there were different initiatives set up to kind of count these deaths. And then I did my own searches, Google searches, you know, 7-8 pages in, looking at different teen shot, death, gun, I mean, a range of things. So these were the 10 that I found. I'm pretty confident that there were more. I don't think there were many more, but there would have been more.
And you focused on children's deaths. Obviously, there are adults killed. If you count the tally of children and adults, you arrive at a bigger number. But of course, children, even those that kill one another, as was the case, I believe it was the boy Tyler Dunn, the 11-year-old, was shot by another boy. I mean, you know, this was a boy who was apparently showing his father's loaded gun to his friends. You can't fault another child, right? Tell us about the story of what happened to Tyler Dunn.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, you're right. I concentrate on children, and there are far more adults who were shot dead. I think what makes children different is that while we understand that everybody has to deal with personal responsibility, with children there is also an understanding that there is collective responsibility, that we all have collective responsibility for children, which is why there are particular laws to protect children. So Tyler was shot dead in Marlette, Michigan, a rural town. Tyler lives on a dirt road that's off a dirt road. And this is the only child in the book who lives in an area where people know it's deer hunting season. And he's with his friend, who in the book is called Brandon. It's not his real name. And they're at a sleepover. The dad has gone away trucking. He was supposed to bring the boys, but the boys wanted to stay home and play Xbox or Call of Duty or whatever. And the way Brandon tells it, he is showing Tyler his dad's gun. His dad has left several guns out, some of which are loaded. He's showing Tyler this gun. He goes back to his room to get a milkshake that he's forgotten there, comes back, and Tyler is handing him the gun with the barrel facing towards Tyler. So Tyler's holding the gun kind of butt first, if you like. And he hands it to Brandon. And Brandon's story is that he's trying to put it down. It gets caught on his pants pocket and shoots Tyler in the head. Which is a, you know, tragic, tragic story.
Now you, the children that you tell, whose stories you tell, range in age from 9 to 19. The youngest, Jaden Dixon, is the boy whose story you open with. And of course, the younger these children are, the more heartbreaking the stories are, the more innocent these children appear. And this story, just a horrific story, Jaden Dixon shot in the face. I mean, you know, this is the kind of story that ought to shock the nation, but because it's an individual rather than say a Sandy Hook style mass shooting, it goes sort of unnoticed. So let's focus on Jaden Dixon and his story, which has just been such a tragedy for his family, his community, and his mother. Tell us what happened to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, Jaden is the first story because he's the first to be shot in that period. So I just take the cases as they come. So I didn't put him at the beginning for dramatic effect, really. Huh. He just happened to be the first one who got shot. Nicole, Jaden's mum, has a rule. Jaden, if you're up, if you're all the way up, socks, shoes, ready for school, then you can do what you want until we're ready to go. So Jaden liked to watch Duck Dynasty, play Minecraft, play Xbox. And I think that morning he was playing Xbox and there's a ring at the door. The assumption is that it's two girls from down the road who sometimes will come to borrow sugar or get a ride or, you know, milk, something like that. So he runs to the door when the doorbell rings. And he opens the door, kind of crouching behind it as though to jump out and shout boo. But nobody comes in. So everybody else in the house kind of looks at the door, and Jaden just peers around the corner of the door, and bang, he's shot square in the head by a guy called Danny Thompson, who is the father of Jaden's older brother and his mother's ex-partner. And then Danny Thompson, it transpires that he told his son when he was living with Nicole, I would think nothing of making you an orphan killing your mother and your brothers. I'm not going to be a 50-year-old man living in my car with no job and nowhere to live. I'd rather be taken out suicide by cop. And so this is effectively what happens. He shoots Jaden in the head. He then runs off, jumps in his car, drives to the workplace of a former partner and the mother of one of his children, shoots her, but doesn't kill her. Shoots her in the stomach. And then drives to a Walmart car park where he gets into a shootout with the police and is killed. This is in a quite sleepy suburb of Columbus, Ohio. And this gets, because of the drama of it, it gets local news. But beyond Columbus, if you're in Cleveland or Toledo, the news like this wouldn't travel far beyond Columbus, basically.
And of course, it is a common pattern for gun violence to be something that happens between people who know one another, often estranged partners or spouses. And we see a lot of violence aimed at women via guns. And in this case, certainly the woman was impacted, but her child killed. Mm. Tell us, Gary, the 10 boys, and they happen to be boys, that you chronicle in this book, the majority were African-American, including Jaden, although light-skinned, his father is black. And is that unusual for black kids to be disproportionately impacted by gun violence, setting aside police violence against black children or black people in general?
No, it's normal that they would be disproportionately affected, but it's not normal that they would that it would be in these proportions. Because it's a random day, therefore you get random results. So on an average day, of the 7 kids who would be shot dead, 3 would be black, 3 would be white, 1 would be Latino. And then every third day, an Asian American or Native American or Pacific Islander would be rotated into that number. Mm-hmm. So that would still mean African Americans were disproportionately affected, but not to the extent in this book of the 10, 7 are black, 2 are Latino, 1 is white. So that's disproportionate. Of the 7 who would be shot dead, also on an average day, 2 would be women. But this is not an average day, it's a random day, and so there are no young women.
Yeah. Now, there are several black teens in your book, and this is an interesting aspect of your book, I think, that it is worth discussing, because often black teenagers, particularly boys, are demonized, criminalized in American society. They're not even seen as children. An 18-year-old or 19-year-old is seen as a man. You know, we had Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown, who were described by the people who killed them as these, you know, adult figures, even though they were just children. How important is it for us to humanize black teenage boys, particularly those, say, 16 to 19, who are still children?
Well, that's just it. I mean, legally, one could make the argument that from 18, you know, you can vote and so on, and a couple of them are 18, few of them are 18 or older. But the kind of people that make those arguments, if their kid was in college and was a freshman, they would call him a kid.
Yeah.
Kids. And when you read the autopsies and you read about the peach fuzz, you know, on their lip, and you look at their Twitter feeds and their Facebook pages, they're kids. Among them, you know, favorite films are, you know, Happy Feet and SpongeBob and so on. And it is one of the things that really struck me doing this book is the degree to which there is an empathy gap for the kind of kids who get killed in this book. So there is an assumption, and you see it in the comments below the line, underneath the stories, there is an assumption that these children, because of where they live and their race, that these children are feral and that their parents are negligent. And it doesn't matter if it's not true. That's what a section of America thinks, which is one of the reasons why I think it's so difficult to galvanize large numbers of people around any kind of gun control initiative, is because they think that this couldn't happen to them. Not because statistically they're better off or because they're white or whatever, but because they're better people. So there was one boy in particular, Samuel Brightman, who got just 81 words in the Dallas Morning News after he was shot. He was just walking down the road, 11:30, with his friend when he was shot dead. Nobody knows why. One of the comments under the article says, "Well, I always know where my children are, and you've got to wonder what his parents were thinking." And then you find his mom, and you hear what kind of evening he'd had. He had been watching We're the Millers with his friend, drinking cocoa, and playing Uno. The worst thing Samuel had done that night was cheat at Uno. And he was walking down the road with his friend Denzel, who'd come over because he was going to take his granny to church the next day, and he was shot. And when you find his mom and you hear about Samuel, who was the kind of boy that the women in his life, the older women, say any mother would want, if you show up and you've got shopping, Samuel is going to run out and help you with the shopping. He doesn't even need to be asked. A very gentle, quite fragile boy, actually. And then you see the comments after the article, and you realize that people have made up their mind that on some level, Samuel had it coming. And that is just a terrible indictment of an empathy gap, which of course is sustained by a range of both racial and, Samuel's African-American, racial and economic segregations.
And I mean, there's so much to say on that front about how our recent election played out as well. But Gary, let's talk about the Latinos, Latino boys that are also killed quite often. In your book, the day that you picked, it happened to be a day that two Latino boys, I believe, is it two that were shot? One of them, a very tragic story. I mean, they're all tragic, obviously. Pedro Cortez in San Jose. This was a boy who I understand was legally blind, and he was just shot dead. What happened to Pedro?
Well, Pedro lives in this area of San Jose that is dominated by, pretty sure it's a Norteños gang. And someone in his crew, his friends, is wearing red, which is the color of the Norteños. And somebody drives by. Someone has been charged, but I don't think they've been convicted. And it's a drive-by. They shoot. And they miss his friend, and they get him. And this is one of those examples where people can dismiss this as it's gang related, as though there's nothing you can do.
And is there also the standard implication, well, he had it coming, maybe he was in the wrong place or associating with the wrong people?
Yeah, I think when people talk about things being gang related, it's a way of dismissing them as these deaths as belonging to kind of pathological subgenre, that it couldn't happen to me or my children because we are not in gangs. That's not the way we operate. This is the product of a kind of almost ethnic dysfunction. And the reality is that, first of all, these kids are often gang related in the way that I describe it in the book as if you were in the Soviet Union, you might be in a communist party, or if you're in Iraq, you might be in the Ba'ath party. It doesn't mean you believe in it. Actually, if gangs dominate an area or an apartment complex or something, then you are gang related just by being born there, just by living there, you're gang related. And you have to kind of navigate what you're going to do about that. But also, if we take this example of Pedro, well, someone got shot for, and I don't think he was even wearing red, but even if he was, kids are getting shot for wearing the wrong color shirt. So even if Pedro and his friends identified with the gang, even if they did, they were walking down the road. They weren't doing anything gang related. And I think it's a way of dismissing the primary issue here, which is that other Western countries have the same problems more or less that America has. I'm in Britain now, but I've seen a lot of the world. Most of the world has gangs, racism, poverty, inequality, segregation, mental health issues, all of those things. The one thing they don't have is the free and easy availability of lethal weapons. And so this book would not be possible in any other Western country. And so while one might debate the degree to which some of these shootings are gang-related, the certainty is that they're all gun-related.
Is there a danger of casting victims of gun violence as... Is there a danger when we cast victims of gun violence as innocent? Because I know that there are times, of course, when when you have even victims of, say, police violence, often there's a scramble to bring up the good qualities of the person that was shot, as though if there was one bad thing that person might have done, somehow they deserve to die.
I think there is. I think obviously, when one is writing a profile of these kids, one wants to be honest and you want to say the good things that they've done and so on. But there is a way in which people can foreground the fact that someone was an A student or had never been in trouble with the police or whatever it was, whatever it is, that in some ways suggests that if they were a B student, they would have had it coming. Right. Or if they were right. A C student, or if they had trouble with the police. And so that desire for the worthy victim suggests that there are worthless victims. And it's a kind of rhetorical shortcut that really, I think, ultimately, I understand why people do it, but ultimately is very unhelpful, not least because the people most likely to be killed come from criminalized communities. And so the chance, if you're African-American and poor and live in a black and poor area, is that you have had a scrape with the police, that your upbringing might have been messy, that you might have been suspended from school, that there are a range of things that are more likely in areas where people are poor and generally excluded. And so when we frame it as innocents and babes and angels, first of all, it's an attempt to sanctify the victim as opposed to portray them as real kids, real people. And secondly, it leaves an awful lot of families and communities feeling alienated, feeling like, well, no one's going to say that about my kid or my area or whatever. So a lot of the parents in this book spend a lot of effort trying to explain why their kid shouldn't have been shot. And they say, he's never been in trouble with the police. He's never done this. He's never done that. And it's, that's heartbreaking. And there's the case in point where I make this argument is the oldest boy to be shot, Kenneth Mills Tucker, who the only police record I could find for him was where he was stopped for, and I quote, failing to come at a full stop, a complete stop at a stop sign. And he is apprehended. Then his car is ransacked because the police officer says they smell marijuana. They don't find any marijuana, but they do find a pipe that might be used for marijuana that they say has marijuana residue in it. And on that basis, he is given a citation. He died before the case could come up for drug paraphernalia. Now, that's clearly racial profiling. If everybody who failed to come to a complete stop at a stop sign was arrested, the police would be doing nothing else. What it does is count Kenneth Mills Tucker out of any conversation that starts, he'd never been in trouble with the law.
Right.
But the law is not some neutral, objective force. We know that about America. I think very few people would seriously dispute that, not if they wanted to be taken seriously, that the law moves with great prejudice against certain groups, the poor and the non-white. And so they are less likely to have the narrative behind them that one can say, babe, angel, saint, you know, innocent. Because if you're born black and poor, then you're guilty of that at the very least. And, you know, that those roads are more likely to lead to other guilt than if you were born white and rich.
Gary, how is the United States viewed from where you sit? I know you lived in the US, obviously, and that's where you did your book, but you're back in Britain now. How do your fellow Brits view our gun culture? Are they completely blown away by something that just doesn't make sense to them?
Yeah. I mean, basically, it's one of the two things that they, in my experience, British people really don't understand. The other one is healthcare.
Right. And maybe now the election of Donald Trump.
See, closer to understanding that, actually. We've had Brexit.
Right, there you go. Okay.
Japan, the Dutch have, Geert Wilders. Every country's got its Trump, and Trumps are doing quite well right now. Yeah. Yeah, the gun, I did an event before I came out to cover the election. Excuse me. Sorry, it's late here. before I came out to cover the election, I did an event in a town called Henley on Thames, which is a very posh town for the very posh people, nearly all white, quite conservative. And they don't understand. You know, it's not just liberals that don't understand. They don't understand. They're like, why would they not fix this? What is it? You know, and most of the questions when I do events here are kind of either surely they're going to do something about this, or they're not going to do anything about this, are they? And each time there's a mass shooting or you know, some kind of horror of that kind, in The Guardian as elsewhere, somebody says, so do you think this will shift the dial on gun control? And you have to tell them, you know, if Sandy Hook didn't do it, then Charleston, South Carolina is not going to do it, Aurora is not going to do it, that none of these other, you know, horrors are going to do it. And any one of these, do I need to fix the noise in the
background? No, it's fine.
Okay. Any one of these would be enough in another country. In Britain, we had one case in Dunblane of a gunman who went into a school and shot a lot of children. And then they just, you know, then they said, okay, we're gonna put these controls on who can have guns, and nobody thought anything about it. And people understand what a constitution is. They don't understand why this particular amendment should be treated as scripture,
yeah,
and then interpreted, misinterpreted, I believe, but in any case, interpreted in the way that it is when it's clearly an 18th century document and this is a 21st century moment. And obviously, the crafters of that amendment did not anticipate automatic weaponry in the 21st century.
Well, Gary, I know it's late, so we want to let you go. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. Really appreciate your work.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Gary Young, the Alfred Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute, award-winning columnist for The Guardian and Nation. We've been discussing his new book, Another Day in the Death of America, A Chronicle of 10 Short Lives. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RUWithSonali.